Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Music Business Podcast presented by Hypebot.com. I'm your host, Kyle Boleyn. Today on the show, I'm talking with Anu Kirk, the former director of music services at Sony Network Entertainment. He spent over 3 years as the business owner of Sony Music Unlimited, a global multi-platform music subscription service. He also worked on Mog and Rhapsody for several years. I'm going to talk to Kirk about Spotify Now, Pandora's acquisition of Next Big Sound, and music streaming services more broadly. We're going to talk about who is creating the best product and how could they improve on that product. These are all important questions to think about as the music industry gets ready for the announcement of Apple Music on Monday. Make sure that you subscribe to Music Business Podcast in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow the show and get the latest episodes on SoundCloud. If you like the show, I would love for you to rate us highly and submit a review. This helps other listeners find the podcast and discover the show. As I said at the top of the show, I'm joined by Anu Kirk. Say hello, Anu.
Hello.
I think every music service is making a move right now. The most recent move came today from Spotify. They're getting into video. They're going to offer short clips from dozens of major partners. Why is Spotify getting into video? My guess is that it has more to do with investor pressure over consumer demand, or I don't know, maybe Spotify is afraid that subscriptions aren't growing as fast as they hoped. It's really hard to say. What is your take on this?
Yeah, it's a combination of factors. I've been saying for years that Spotify is sort of in trouble. And the shortest answer I can give here is Spotify is getting into video because they have to. They are backed up against a wall. They really don't have any other choice. They're competing against companies like Apple and Amazon and Microsoft and Google, who are all offering music services and are going to roll those music services into integrated media services that include video and apps and games and all these things. And Spotify has reached a point where they can't keep going back to investors and asking for more money for music when they've obviously kind of tapped out the growth or the potential there. Their valuation is so high that the only way they can justify it and the only way they can possibly defend against these titans coming after them is to expand out into other media properties, with video being the most obvious one. I think today's announcement was sort of the thing that surprised me the most about it was kind of how odd the video offerings are. They have a sort of a real dearth of original content. They're offering clips of things. And the thing that comes to my mind is, why is anyone going to go to Spotify to watch video clips instead of YouTube? How is this experience going to be good enough that it's going to pull viewing habits away from it? Maybe they're just banking on the fact that you're already in Spotify for listening to music or you've already got it running. But looking at what they've got right now, I feel like it is a prototype or kind of testing the waters for what is a strategy or plan for them to get more into YouTube or Netflix or Hulu's type of video distribution.
I was reading a Wired news story about Spotify's launch. I really liked this quote. Spotify seriously wants your attention before someone else steals it. The problem is there are already plenty of companies satisfying that appetite for music and video. The ultimate question is, who is Spotify competing for attention with? Are they basically trying to compete with anyone else that plays videos?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think that quote from Wired is right on. Spotify wants you to spend more of your attention on them, not other people. And the interesting thing about it is, from like a consumer perspective, it's basically Spotify saying, don't watch that video clip on YouTube. Come and watch it on our platform instead. And the sort of cynical or lazy or inertial user is just going to say, well, why? You know, why am I going to change my behavior for you just because you want me to watch you instead of somebody else? And so far, at least, I haven't seen anything that answers that question in a real satisfying way. And I think that's really ultimately what's driving it. They're just looking for ways to get more earlobes or eyeballs or faces pointed in their direction so that they can either try to extract revenue or show advertising.
Absolutely. And it's sort of this challenge where Spotify at its core appeals to music fanatics, people who see value in unlimited access to music. To reach the broader market, they've had to dumb down the offering, add the radio tier, add ever more enhanced playlists. And there's really a limit to which they can try to bring that person in. So instead of making the product even more simple, just one big play button, now they're adding video on top of that. You know, if we can't innovate on playlists, let's just give you something to watch for 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. And there's something that's sort of disappointing about that from a music perspective. You know, if you really wanted to be dark about this, this is Spotify beginning to admit that, you know, music is just not going to work, or music is clearly not enough. It's one thing if they had wanted to emulate Vevo and be showing music videos and rolling that in. That's something that, for example, iTunes has done. Rhapsody and various other music services have shown music videos and things like that as well, or done little music video shows and things like that. But for Spotify to, in some sense, this is a signaling that they're trying to rebrand themselves as more than just music, but really just kind of entertainment. But it's a pretty limp offering for spearheading that. And it does sort of signal that on some level, they're saying, well, music isn't enough.
I don't have any intimate knowledge of Vevo's business model or the state of the company, but it's usually not a good sign when the CEO and the head of product leave.
Well, I know I've met Rio, the guy who was the CEO for Vevo, and chatted with him a couple times. He's a very smart guy, and some of it may just be fatigue. Dealing with the content cartel can be really trying and exhausting, and he had been doing that for quite a long time and had really built that business up. I'm speculating here. I haven't spoken to him since he stepped down, but it's possible that he was just in a situation where the content owners had unrealistic expectations about the business, or they had a fundamental disagreement about strategy or exit or things along those lines. But you know, ultimately, Vevo has basically been a gatekeeper. Effectively, the content cartel got together and said, hey, instead of us just giving all of our content away for free to all these people, why don't we create effectively like a clearinghouse or a portal that's the single source for all these things, and then we can charge people money for it. And that's basically what Vevo's model was. And it was reasonably successful for them.
Can you go into that some?
Well, you know, basically, if you want to show most official music videos, Vevo is the place that you're going to go to acquire or license them. And for things like YouTube, it was an easy way for them to create an entity that could monitor and take down all the infringing stuff or otherwise monetize the illicit uploads and become a single source. And because Vevo was acting as the gatekeeper, I can't say for sure because it's not information I have, but I would imagine that YouTube was paying Vevo a significant amount of money in order to get access to those music.
And sharing a significant portion of the ad revenue, I'm sure.
Yes.
So also with this news today, we have Spotify adding podcasts to the platform, which is interesting. Deezer recently acquired Stitcher. I believe Deezer also announced today that podcasts are now available throughout their platform. I mean, personally, I like podcasts a lot. I would say my podcast listening has displaced my music listening just because staying up on what's happening and hearing a good story, at least for me lately, has been better than going back to a bunch of albums I've heard a bunch of times. So what is your take on Spotify getting into podcasts? Are they just hoping to hook people into an hour story and stay in the store longer?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple factors at play here again. One is that podcasts do seem to be having a bit of a moment in terms of cultural popularity and notice between Mark Maron with his WTF podcast and interviews and Serial and various other things that people are actually finally paying attention to. It's taken almost whatever, 10, 12, 15 years, but people are finally paying attention to podcasts. It's hard for me, again, to see how Spotify rolling them into their platform is, you know, revolutionary or a big deal. It's more like Spotify saying, well, you know, some percentage of our users is listening to podcasts anyway, so maybe we can do a marginally better job or equivalent job of folding them into the listening experience since they're already here. But for everyone who's already listening to podcasts, they already have a solution. And I don't, again, I don't think Spotify is going to see big subscriber uplift or big changes in retention around this feature. You know, again, this is something that services have dabbled with in the past. We've certainly talked about it at Moog and Rhapsody and Music Unlimited and all the other music services I've worked with. And what it really came down to is this is content that generally you can get for free someplace else. So there's something that is, on the one hand, sort of disingenuous and possibly illegal about charging people a subscription fee to get at it. But I think ultimately it's just Spotify saying, well, look, if you're going to pay attention to some kind of media portal, maybe we, Spotify, can deliver it and capture a little more of your interest. And I think that's really what they're looking at. Again, all this would be a little bit more compelling if Spotify were either doing exclusive deals or generating some original content or having some sort of strategy other than, well, we're going to offer a bunch of these things. Again, you can look at the iTunes store. They've been offering podcasts and a fairly sophisticated feature set around those podcasts for quite some time. But it's not a killer app for most people. And even with all of that, there's plenty of people who are still going directly to the various websites for whatever podcast they're interested in and downloading it from there.
Does Spotify want to become a media portal? I've heard several people make the comparisons to Yahoo, AOL, or MSN, as in that seems to be the lane that Spotify is going in here.
Well, I don't have any particular inside information, even though I've worked with some of the people there on the MU to Spotify transition. But again, looking at their market situation, it's hard to believe that they don't feel compelled to do that. Running a music subscription service, the model that's been around for, you know, nearly 15 years, which is $10 a month for unlimited songs, is clearly difficult for them to justify their current valuation and burn rate and engineering and all that overhead. And if they can tell a story convincingly to the public and to investors that, you know, they do have this larger strategy about being a media portal, well, then you can start to see some reasons why they might have that kind of valuation or why you might want to put even more money in. I just don't see how they cannot be telling that story. And I think if nothing else, you could look at today's announcements as being sort of trial balloons or baby steps in that direction, a way for them to kind of demo or build this functionality in a way that's not mission critical. It's a lot safer for them to do what they're doing today than to basically say, hey, you know, in X number of months, we're going to launch a direct Netflix competitor.
Which is something that Ardio tried to do with their video offering. I believe that was shuttered in under a year.
Yeah, and I think they were looking at it for exactly the same reasons, of basically looking down the road and saying, oh man, you know, we're just this little scrappy, very high quality music service, but we're going to be competing against Google and Apple and Microsoft and Amazon and all these companies that are going to roll all these services together in one giant offering that's going to be very appealing to users. And you either have a choice of, you know, hoping one of these companies buys you, or finding a relatively small niche market to eke out an existence in while they vacuum up the majority of people around the planet. You know, and I think the thing with the video service is they were just early. It's very difficult to get those rights. It requires lots of money and lots of credibility. And at the time, RDO didn't have either.
It sounds like Apple is going to be coming out with their own TV service as well, alongside their music service.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. You know, Apple is kind of in an interesting position. They are so dominant in music. In a very short period of time, just a couple of years, they went from basically not selling music at all, like at all, to being, I think in America, the last numbers I checked a couple months ago, they represent literally like two-thirds of the music business in America now. And I think the video companies, the movie studios, a lot of which also own record labels, are sitting there going, oh my God, we do not want to let these guys do that to our movie business, our television business. So they've been playing real hardball with Apple around pricing and rights and everything else. And I think Apple has to, again, has to do this for the same reasons that Amazon and Microsoft and Google and even Sony have done. These are all companies that have these expensive and complicated hardware, software ecosystems, and they all need more people to spend more time and more money on it. And all of these Titan companies are looking at cable TV. You know, the typical American household spends upwards of $100 a month on cable television, and nobody likes it. It's a pretty crappy entertainment experience by today's standards. And all those companies are sitting there saying, geez, it's $1,200 a year that is ripe for the picking. And you can easily see how Apple or Amazon or Microsoft or Google or some of these other giant companies could roll together a package of video on demand and music on demand and maybe books on demand and games or apps on demand and price it at $50 a month or $100 a month and basically say, why are you paying for cable when you could be paying for this instead and it'll work on all your devices and give you all of this content on demand wherever you are? And I think that's really the end game for a lot of these folks. Apple's success in music has made it more difficult for it to get off the ground in these other areas because the movie companies and all the other content cartel folks are just afraid to give them anything approaching a reasonable deal because they don't want Apple to end up with two-thirds of the business for everything.
My dad has been a Dish Network subscriber for as long as I can remember. This summer, I was home working on my book, and we'd often get into conversations about the quality of the television. We'd be sitting there watching a show. It would go into commercial, and my dad would just get vivid. He's just like, oh my gosh, like it's going to be 5 or 10 minutes of commercials. I'm going to forget what's even happening in the show. I just can't stand this anymore. I can't stand the television. It's so horrible. There's nothing on. It's always commercials. If I can, I'll DVR a show, watch it, and skip through all of the commercials because I just can't afford to have my time wasted by all of that, all of those ads. You know, my dad's, he works by day as a laborer at an Air Force base and by night he's a farmer. And only on those kind of like rainy nights or winter nights does he have time to sit down in front of the television. But if he's just going to sit in front of a bunch of ads, he just does not have the patience for it anymore.
Well, I think that's the way most people feel. It's interesting that even Hulu has increased its ad load noticeably over the last couple of years. And there's something that feels kind of crummy about paying for the premium version of Hulu and having to sit through ads. But that is that's the model that you got. And I think one of the things that the entertainment industry hasn't fully grokked is if they don't think about pleasing their customers. Their customers are going to eventually just start stealing the content one way or another. And I think because the entertainment industry or the content cartel has effectively had a monopoly on distribution for so long, they're not really used to actually thinking about what does the customer want and really have more of a mindset of the customer will take what we give them. You know what I mean?
Well, I do know what you mean. That's the mindset that the record industry had for a number of years.
Yeah, and you can see how well it's worked out for them. And so I feel like there's a real chance that, I mean, look at how HBO basically got kind of strong-armed into launching HBO Go for everybody to use. And they still have staggering amounts of piracy because people think it's too expensive.
Going back to a thread that we were into earlier, I've always believed that if Apple improved iTunes even on a marginal level, so it was just more simple, more usable, more clear where everything is, they do a huge service to tens of millions of people. Like, the bar for them is just making a really crappy product better, and a lot of people would be overjoyed, I think, to use it.
Yeah. Well, I was just struggling with iTunes a little bit earlier today. I seem to have this issue where even though I'm telling it to insert album art, it fails to insert album art. But to give them to be contrarian for a second, iTunes is a really tough product to build from a product design and product management perspective. It's morphed from basically being an MP3 player to being an MP3 player plus a portable device manager. And then on top of all that, it now has a content store and some amount of photo management, and until Apple just split it out recently, also like podcast management and iPhone management and all this other stuff has just kind of gotten shoehorned in there. And this is a difficult problem to solve. It's what Donald Norman would call the sort of clock radio problem, right? And he in one of his wonderful design books, he talks about how his first exercise for a lot of design students is having them design an interface for a clock radio. And on the one hand, you think about it and you're like, well, how freaking hard can that be, right? But then you start thinking about all the clock radios you've had in your life that were incredibly frustrating and difficult to set up and all the rest of it. And iTunes' problem at this point is that it's trying to do like five different sort of related things, and it's very schizophrenic about what it's supposed to be. Now, what's the solution here? Do they shatter the single application into a bunch of other ones and have a separate music playing app and a separate iPhone management app and a separate photo management app and, a separate video management app? I don't know that that's really appreciably any better. I think, my gripes with it tend to be more that it seems like the actual functionality of the features that they do have is degraded. But there's a larger, I think what people really are responding to is the fact that this application feels very comprehensive and large, and it doesn't feel elegant or fun or easy to use. You could even make an argument that really it shouldn't be an app at all, but this sort of stuff should just kind of disappear into the operating system. It should be more ambient rather than focused, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's all really interesting and also excellent points, given how much you've worked on product and kind of have an insight on how the sausage gets made there. So yesterday I read that Pandora has acquired Next Big Sound. To me, the deal seems more about brands than bands. I think that Pandora will help brands target specific users and measure the results. I know that Next Big Sound has been working with brands in recent years to help them find relevant artists that align with their voice and their vibe, and helping them measure the campaigns that they do with those artists in terms of the social streaming activity that's sort of like catalyzed as a result. Did this deal of Pandora acquiring Next Big Sound also leave you with that impression?
Well, I think there's a couple of different ways you can look at it. And I'm speculating. I haven't spoken to anybody at Pandora about this. But one approach you could see is that maybe Pandora is trying to kind of make itself more valuable to the labels. And, Pandora has not done a great job, in my opinion, over the last few years of kind of managing their public image with artists and content owners. And this might be a way for them to say, hey, look, we're going to start offering you all of this great data about how your artist is trending and where they're trending. Or maybe they're going to use the data to provide better channels or better radio stations for people. It's hard for me to see how this is a consumer benefit in the short term. I think it's more about them trying to look for other ways to monetize their existing businesses, either by selling data to the content cartel or getting more favorable terms or offering something to artists so that artists get a little less hostile towards them at the moment. But I don't really see an immediate thing where it's like, oh, well, this is how they're going to make their product better for users. I think it's more about kind of business-to-business offerings and working the content side of things a bit more.
It'll definitely be weird if we start seeing trending radio stations based on Next Big Sound data, as if Pandora couldn't have already done that in some way.
Maybe they just weren't happy with the results they were getting internally. Maybe part of what they want to do is establish themselves. A lot of these digital music companies kind of started off with a sort of punky outsider attitude towards the music business. You know, wanted to replace it or innovate or kick out the dinosaurs or whatever. But, you know, now at this point in 2015, all of these companies are the music business, right? There's no more record stores. And, streaming and download revenue is outstripping physical revenue. And so these companies now need to have some kind of legitimacy and have to have a better relationship with the labels and the artists. They can't just kind of do whatever they want. I mean, look at Grooveshark is a good example of that sort of old school punk attitude and how far it gets you these days. Those guys just got, smashed out of existence. So I think a lot of it is more about Pandora trying to position themselves as being more like Billboard or some of the other services out there where the industry, instead of just looking at Pandora as bloodsuckers that are, and the language is always like, they're building their business on the backs of our content, to turn it more into, we work with those guys, they provide useful data, and, we like them.
I like how your record label impression was almost like a pirate. The other thing that's really intriguing about this is that I don't think there are any more data companies left. Live Nation bought Big Champagne, Spotify acquired the Equinest, Apple purchased Symmetric, and now Pandora has snapped up Next Big Sound. Who is left out there? It's really unclear to me whether the music data market is opening up or winding down.
Well, the big challenge for these music data companies is just that it's kind of a small market. At best, when the industry was in full swing, you had maybe 10 or a dozen customers possible of significance. And running a company like that is a real challenge. I mean, if you look at someone like Echonest, how many deals could they really do that were going to be material for them? 8? 10? And how many of those deals had they done? Even if you look at someone like Big Champagne, how many companies really care about what Big Champagne's data is? You can probably really count them on both hands. So I think it's really just an issue that if you're going to run a company like that, you either have to be very efficient and very lean, or you have to expect that someone inside is going to pick you up. You could compare it to is it Nate Silver, who's got the 586.org? And those guys do data analysis, but they cast a huge, broad net. And part of why they do that is it's the only way that their business can be viable. You can't go really narrow with that stuff. There's just too few companies that really need the data enough to pay for it in a way that'll let you sustain a business. And when you're in that situation, if you look at something like Spotify acquiring Echonest, the great thing about that from Spotify's perspective is no matter how much money they paid for Echonest, it put so much immediate hurt on all of their competitors, because all of their competitors were like, oh crap, now we're putting money in Spotify's pocket. We have to stop that. We have to find another solution. It was extraordinarily disruptive for everybody else who had deals with Echonest.
I read a stat once that said Echonest powered recommendations that reached, I think, like 195 million users because every single company was using their recommendations.
Yeah, it's the same thing with like Rovi, who owns AllMusic. One of my former Rhapsody colleagues used to refer to them as Pravda because they were sort of like, their reviews were the source of truth because everybody was using them. And it didn't matter whether the reviews were good or accurate or anything else. It's just like, you go to every music service and you'd see that same Stephen Thomas Erlewine write-up about whatever band, and people would be like, yes, this is the news.
I think Slacker was using those reviews for a number of years, and you just see at the bottom, some guy's name, Rovi. And like, oh, okay, you are the gospel on whatever band that I'm interested in right now.
Yeah, yeah. And when you see that same review at RDO and Spotify and Rhapsody and, Wikipedia, it sort of starts to lose meaning. But they have sort of a similar problem. They built this really nice database of information, but they were really the only source for it. It was too difficult for anybody to get in and compete in any meaningful way. And if everybody's got the same data, it's not really worth having.
So I realize that this is a much bigger story and almost maybe a podcast in and of itself, but you mentioned GrooveShark a little bit ago, and I'm really interested to hear your take on what happened, how it finally shut down. It kind of keeps popping up, but then it gets shut down again. Like, what is your overall take on what happened with GrooveShark?
Well, fundamentally, in some ways, the GrooveShark situation is a problem 100% of the record industry's own devising. GrooveShark, in some ways, was the last of a series of businesses whose model was basically break the law and hope that everybody doesn't notice until you're so big that they have to do a deal with you, and then you can go legit. And this is something that really started with Napster, the original Napster. There was a point where the original Napster, when Homer Winblad, the venture capital firm, was running it, was offering the record industry $1 billion, with a B, to sell non-DRM downloads for $1 each. And the record industry said, absolutely not. We're never going to let that happen. No one will ever be selling singles without DRM for $1 apiece. It's never, ever going to happen. And shut Napster down. But the record industry continued to endorse, like after Napster went into receivership, its assets got bought by a bunch of different companies and sort of passed around, and they continued to endorse legitimate music businesses using the Napster brand. And there were other companies that had similar paths of kind of launching either totally illegal services or quasi-legal services and basically hoping that they would get acquired or get big enough that they could negotiate and go legit. Even Turntable.fm was another recent example. And in GrooveShark's case, it just didn't work. Management at GrooveShark was not sufficiently contrite and not interested in really negotiating with the labels. And frankly, I think they had also bad legal advice or a poor understanding of the actual law, and continued with a very combative relationship with the labels. And the labels didn't like it, so they just kept beating them down. And I believe what happened with the couple of clones that popped up is the same sort of thing that happened with like Kazaa and some of the other sort of open source sharing or torrenting types of services. People just downloaded some software from a repository and set up a copy of it somewhere. And the content industry, it's not just a music problem, but the content industry is continually trying to squash those things. As they should. I mean, there's something that's pretty messed up when, you're trying to run a legitimate business. Whatever you may think of Spotify or Rhapsody or Netflix or Hulu, these are companies where people are working very hard and have invested a lot of resources in building a legitimate portal that is doing what they can to make sure that the content owners get paid. And if you have to compete against a service that's running something totally free and not paying anybody, like, that's just ridiculous. How can you possibly do that?
I remember encountering GrooveShark, I think, in 2008 or 2009. I was a student at a music business school, and one of the teachers was like, hey, check out this thing called GrooveShark. It's like, oh, wow, it's this music service in a web browser that lets you play anything you want. And I think that was probably the first time that I'd ever encountered something like that, because I had never... at least at that point in time, I had never used Rhapsody or Moog or any of the other services. Mm-hmm. And I remember in the coming years, as I grew to become a music business journalist, saying like, these free trials, they're just not long enough. I don't think they work. When is someone going to make them just like GrooveShark? Years later, Spotify comes along, offers the free tier. And now GrooveShark is getting shut down, and people are saying like, oh, how do we shut down the free tier at Spotify? Meanwhile, Spotify is saying, here's more things for free that we can give you. It's so like music industry has such like a weird backwards history of like repeat events in like different ways.
Oh, for sure. And I think part of the problem is that people in the music business have a really uncomfortable relationship with free. You know, they say, well, we don't want free music, or we want free music, but not like that. I mean, look at FM radio, for example. You know, there was in the early days of FM stereo, it was a very similar conversation to what's been going on the last couple of years of artists and record companies saying you cannot allow these FM radio stations to broadcast all this high fidelity music for free. They're just giving away our records. And DJs would literally say, okay, I'm now going to play side two of the new Led Zeppelin album with no commercial breaks. And, you know, was it destructive? Well, radio turned into a multi-billion dollar business where content owners and artists have repeatedly broken federal law to pay to get their music played on the radio. And even today, in radio's twilight years, people still think it's important enough that they will do all kinds of crazy things to get their song on radio. And it's free. You look at something like Spotify, should that be free? Well, I don't know. I really don't. But I do know that people have a high resistance to paying for it, at least at the prices and the way that it's offered right now. That doesn't mean that I think people should just go ahead and start services that are ignoring artist rights and not paying anybody just because. But there has to be a better way to figure out that, you know, I wrote a thing on my blog recently where I was noting that there has to be some space between the current polls of charging people $10 a month, which is clearly too expensive from the customer's perspective, and nothing, which is just frankly dumb from a business and content valuation perspective. And I'm disappointed with our industry collectively for not doing more investigation or testing or innovation in that area.
What do you think about RDO Select? They just came out with a $3.99 tier. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I've you know, certainly at the services that I've worked at, we've experimented with all different kinds of price points and offers. I think the main problem is that $3.99 is still too expensive for a limited service like that. I haven't used it enough myself to be able to say whether I think it's something that's going to resonate with the broader market, but I certainly wouldn't pay for it. I'm of the perspective that if I'm going to pay anything, I don't have a problem paying $10 a month, but I'm a musician and a hardcore music fan.
And you might
don't think it's going to be a magic bullet for RDO.
Possibly in emerging markets or something like that, but I don't really see it taking off in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. And part of it is because if you don't want to pay for music, well, there's enough free music services out there between Spotify and YouTube that you don't have to. So, you know, like, the question becomes, like, do you really think that there's a market of people who are like, well, gee, I really want to pay for music, but I can't come up with $10 a month, but I can come up with $4 a month. That's okay. You know, I'm sure that they have some smart people there. I've met with some of the folks over there, and they run a good business. I just don't think it's going to be a successful product. It's one of those things that it feels like it's being designed from the business or boardroom out instead of starting with what's going to work for the customer.
It's interesting that music videos operate in this gray area of, are they a marketing material or a music medium? Consume them for free, and I might buy the music. Or I consume them for free, and I don't need to buy any music ever. I feel like no one has a clear idea of where the music video is now and what limits should be put on viewing them.
Yeah, well, I think it's been that way since the beginning. You know, since the very early days of music video, no one really knows, is this like a commercial for the record? Is it an art form in its own right? Is it distracting too much from just the music? Like, Bob Dylan didn't need music videos. You know, the Beatles didn't really need music videos. At the same time, it opens up new possibilities, and there have been some combinations of imagery and music that are extremely powerful. It's just, it's a lot more expense and it's a lot more hassle, and there's very few artists that are creating really compelling, complete works on that. I think the interesting thing is if you go to YouTube and you start poking around, yeah, they got the videos for songs, but I'm guessing, because I haven't done enough research, but I'm willing to bet that YouTube has more non-video, like pure audio dumps of music at this point than it has music videos. And I would include like lyric videos or fan-made videos in the sort of just audio dump portion. You know, I think music videos are just weird. You know, the industry still has an uncomfortable relationship with them after all this time. Artists have spent, in some cases, far more money on the music video for one single than they did recording the entire album.
That's crazy. I mean, but it is crazy. I mean, it is. It has this like long history, and no one's really sure. I mean, some armchair historians of the music business will say that the number one thing that music labels got wrong is that they gave the music videos to MTV for free, and that therein kind of started this like downward trend of music as marketing rather than as music as product.
Well, sure. But, you know, at the same time, if they did the same thing with radio, and you can look just a few years from past when MTV launched, and very quickly, these companies were all begging MTV to put their videos on. You know, they were all but paying MTV. And it was their own fault, right? I mean, they were sending artists out for interviews and special performances and like whatever they could do to get MTV to play that video. I think part of the question is like, would MTV or anyone have paid for it, right? I mean, you can look at radio. Like, do the radio stations pay the labels for music? Well, in some sense they do. They pay songwriter royalties and things like that. But the labels send free copies of albums out, and the labels spend all kinds of money soliciting people to get stuff played on the radio. And MTV was no different. I mean, the problem ultimately becomes, if you want someone to buy your art, first you have to get them to pay attention to your art, right? And until people have paid some kind of attention to it and notice you, you can't just say, oh, well, you know, my art costs $5 or $10 or $20 and you have to pay for it. Because people just be like, no, no, thanks. Not interested. I need some kind of sample. I mean, ice cream shops will give you a taste. They'll give you a free spoonful. And theoretically, if you were really devious, you could have enough free spoonfuls that you don't actually need an ice cream scoop. But nobody really does that.
I think that's a very great example. I mean, you know, in media, it seems like it's a much harder to do that because it's like, well, is it the full song a couple times? Is it 30 seconds of the song, 90 seconds of the song, the video for the song, and the song costs money? Or, you know, now we've just loaded the music video itself full of brand endorsements, so it's okay. Coca-Cola bought the music video; it's free for you.
Right. Right, and it's also challenging because if you are an artist and you say, "I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to play those games." The problem is there is some slightly more desperate artist that will come in right behind you and be like, "Yeah, I'll do it. I'll do it. I'll totally do it." So you can say, "Well, I don't want to give my music away for free." Or I'll give people a 30-second clip, and up comes not just one band, but hundreds of other bands that will literally say, here's our video, you can download it in HD for free. Just watch it, please. Right? And whether or not the content is any good or not, I don't want to get into those sort of subjective levels, but what happens is the consumer perception is, well, if band X is going to give me their stuff for free or let me sample it all the way through or in HD or whatever, why isn't every band doing that, right? And if you, as a content owner or creator or whatever, you certainly have the right to prescribe how your content is consumed. But it's sort of like saying you don't want your music sold in Walmarts. Like, you're totally within your rights to do that, but you are taking it out of the market for a big chunk of the world by doing so. And it's your choice, but there are ramifications for it. And what will happen is if someone walks into a Walmart and they have $10 in their hand and they want to buy a new music CD or DVD or whatever, and you're not there, they're going to buy somebody else's. And it's the same thing with attention. if you're in this attention economy or this attention market where you're trying to get people to pay attention to what you're doing, you kind of have to look at what the status quo is and do that.
Absolutely, because like you said, if you don't, someone else will. So I'd like to switch topics here and talk about music streaming services in general. Every music streaming app is basically the same. They're really not all that different. Why isn't there much innovation these days in music service design?
Well, this is another thing I've been sort of saying for quite some time, and the analogy I use a lot is it's like gas stations. You know, you go to most towns, and on the corner, there's actually four gas stations all on the same corner. And there's a red one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one. And they really are effectively all the same. You know, I haven't talked with all of the people in charge of product at all the different music services, but I think pretty much everybody decided that the model that Rhapsody pioneered was the thing that everybody should copy. And for whatever reason, that's what they've done. If you look at any of the services today and you compare them to Rhapsody 1.0 or 2.0, it's basically exactly the same thing. There might be some minor differences in terms of scale of catalog, because now there's more content that's available legally. There's certainly more devices that these services can run on now, but we all knew this was coming when we started Rhapsody. And there's things like smartphones that also didn't exist, but that we knew were coming as well. I think the main problem is innovation is difficult and hard and scary. And if you're trying to raise a ton of money to go after a company like Spotify that's valued at $5 or $10 billion now, and you want to tell people, hey, we're not going to do it exactly like they do, people start to get a little nervous and they'll be like, well, how do you know you're going to do it right? Why don't you just do it the same way? Like, and there's also a lot of the same people. It's a small industry and a lot of the same folks have moved around to different services and have a lot of the same ideas. I mean, all of these services offer the basics and pretty much all the obvious stuff you'd think. Here's all the music we got. Here's a search engine. Here's a list of new releases. You know, here's a list of what's popular. Here's a picture of the artist. Here's a discography. It's just not presented in any way that feels really innovative or useful. Some of it is because these are hard problems, and some of it is because taking the risk to try something new to solve the problem is scary, especially if you're in as competitive a market as we are.
What is it like moving from one music streaming service to another?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's just the same set of problems. You know, you show up and you've got this basically the same challenging deals with the labels and publishers and artists, the same challenging economics, the same problems of getting your service up and running in a bunch of different companies and on a bunch of different clients. And usually you have the same backlog of features. I mean, part of it, why all these services are the same is that when you start thinking about the obvious things that people would want out of a music service, it's very much like what most of these services look like today. And once you get past all that obvious stuff, which is a significant pile of work to get through, takes years to get through that all, it's hard to have clear consensus about what the right thing to do next is. You know, is it adding podcasts? Is it adding videos? Is it adding a more dynamic homepage or a better radio tier or things like that? These are all questions that, you know, it's funny to watch the industry go through this stuff because nothing's really changed in 15 years. This is the same stuff I've been talking about almost literally every single year for the last 15 years. It's very much the same set of problems, and they're hard to solve.
There's this saying people have about experience. Do you have 15 years of experience or 1 year of experience repeated 15 times?
I would argue that it's, for me at least, it's both of those things. There's definitely been, you know, my sort of, I don't want to say darker moments, but sort of more frustrated moments, a feeling of like it's just the same problems, the same 10 problems over and over and over. But the world changes and the market changes. You know, when Rhapsody 1.0 launched, nobody knew whether a subscription service was a stupid idea or not, or whether it was going to work. And it had like 20,000 tracks, mostly from a classical label. 20,000 tracks. And it only ran on the PC, right? You had to download software, and broadband didn't exist as much. And, you know, now, for example, most people are doing their computing on their phones, on these mobile devices that they're carrying around. That changes things significantly. Having all of the actual content that people want and more content than they know what to do with is significant. I mean, we used to joke about, like, the day that would come when finally, like, Led Zeppelin and AC/DC and the Beatles were all on these services. Well, 2 out of 3. And I'm pretty sure that Apple is going to spend whatever ungodly amount of money it takes to get the Beatles to sign on for whatever service they're going to launch. Not that those acts matter, but it's just a sign of how much the industry has changed. And ultimately, experience is less about kind of do you know how to solve one particular problem, and more about how have you solved problems in the past, and do you have a skill set for diagnosing and identifying and coming up with solutions and testing and iterating and moving forward. I don't know. It's been an entertaining 15 years. I'm proud of the work that I've done. I hope that people continue to move things forward, and who knows, I may be back working in music again someday.
I'd be curious to hear, I mean, if you were to blue sky for a moment, your ideal music service, or a music service that you believe at least a good majority of people would be interested in, what would you want to build?
Well, I'd start with the premise that clearly the $10 a month, 30 million song, Rhapsody, Spotify, whatever you want to call it model is not working. Or at least not working at enough scale to matter. Maybe it's good for the hardest core aficionados, but it feels sort of like a dead end. And you think that if it was really going to light up and work, it would have happened by now. And for comparison, I look at someone like Netflix. They offer, at least superficially, nearly an identical service, but it costs less money and is used by almost everybody who has an internet connection. Right, Netflix themselves, there's all these statistics about what percentage of internet data traffic they single-handedly represent. So why have they figured it out and the music business hasn't? Is it something that's fundamentally different about video and music? I don't think so. I think the problems I would look at are, like, number one, existing music services are too expensive, right? $120 a year is too much to ask most people to pay for. They're just not going to do it. And at the same time, free, with its various restrictions or advertising or all other kind of stuff, that's obviously not the right answer either. So I'd try to come up with a different type of pricing. Just off the top of my head, I think the right price point would be something that is between like $20 and $50 a year. Something that could be cheap enough that it's giftable and could be sold in a one-year chunk or multiple-year chunks rather than billing month to month. The other thing that I'd look at is the content. One of the things that differentiates Netflix from the record business, for example, is that Netflix does not have every single movie ever made. That may be their ultimate goal, but at least for the moment, they have a much smaller catalog. One of the statistics I can share with you that's not particularly proprietary is that the general catalog across all these music services these days is approximately 30 million songs. Okay, up from 20,000 15 years ago, now it's about 30 million songs that are available. If you look at any of those music services and you go talk to them, you will find out that of those 30 million songs, something like 8 million have actually been played at least one time. And the other 22 million songs that have been ingested and stuck on CDNs all around the world and all that kind of stuff, they're just sitting on servers. They're not getting played. And of those 8 million songs that have actually been played one time, there's really only like 4 or 5 million that are actually getting played regularly. So one of the solutions I would look at is just basically getting rid of the crap, right? Pandora has a very small music catalog relative to everybody else. And I would start focusing on having a smaller, higher quality selection of content that's curated better and presented better to the users. I'd start convincing the artists and the labels that you're actually adding value and try and flip the dynamic. So instead of everybody dumping on music services all the time and talking about how they're screwing artists over, why can't we get a similar type of dynamic where the record companies and the artists are falling all over themselves going, please, music service, take my content and stream it to people, right? That's the world that we need to get to. And I think a lot of it is just the kind of inertia in design. The way that these services are presented to users, it doesn't make your life easier. It makes your life harder. And I would be looking at ways to give people kind of a more magical solution where what they want to play is put right in front of them to such a degree that they didn't even know that was what they wanted to play until they saw it. And services these days don't do that. They're still basically a 30 million pile of songs with a search engine on top. And I'm not a very good search engine at that.
I think that is incredibly well said.
Well, thank you. You're very kind.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show tonight and sharing your thoughts about the latest happenings in music tech, as well as music streaming more broadly. If people want to look you up online and connect, where can they find you?
I have a blog called Post Cautious, where I sometimes write about the music business and sometimes write about my own life. If you Google Post Cautious, it'll come right up. You know, my name is spelled A-N-U-K-I-R-K, and if you Google me, I'm really not that hard to track down. I'm on Twitter as Anu Kirk, but I don't check Twitter very much. But yeah, you can. I'm pretty easy to track down online.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show tonight.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me, and I'm happy to do it again anytime.
That's all for this episode of the Music Business Podcast. Thanks to Hypebot for helping us put this show out. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please send me an email at kyle.bylin@gmail.com. That's kyle.bylin@gmail.com. Quite frankly, I'd love to hear from you. Make sure that you also check out my excellent interview with Jim McDermott on Music Exclusives. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode.